Welcome in, kingly brothers and heroic husbands from around the planet. Welcome to this new episode of the Be the Husband She Brags About podcast. In this special guest episode, we welcome in Peter Levine. Peter is the developer of somatic experiencing, a naturalistic and neurobiological approach to healing trauma. He holds doctorates in both biophysics and psychology. He is the founder and president of the Ergos Institute for Somatic Education and the founder and advisor for Somatic Experiencing International. Dr. Levine is the author of several best-selling books on trauma, including Waking the Tiger, Healing Trauma, which has been published in over 29 languages. He has received lifetime achievement awards from Psychotherapy Networker and the U.S. Association for Body-Oriented Psychotherapy. He continues to teach trauma healing workshops internationally. His work has been taught to over 30,000 therapists in over 42 countries. Peter Levine, brother, it's an honor and a privilege to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Sure. Good to connect.
Peter, I will lead. I know you're on the book tour for your beautiful book, An Autobiography of Trauma, A Healing Journey. I want to lead that the most instrumental book for myself in relating with you definitely is Waking the Tiger. Part in a movement here. The husbands listening in, I'm really trying to infuse a trauma-informed awareness. So it's a particular pleasure to have you on the show for that. It's been so transformational in my own marriage transformation. Peter, within your autobiographical account, you spoke about a deep bodily hesitation of actually sharing the intimate parts of your journey. You know, it's one thing teaching, but it's another thing to reveal completely and as transparently and as fully as you did. You, within the book, brought that back to childhood experiences, predominantly in your family's relationship with the mafia growing up. Can you take the guys listening in deeper as to what the story was there?
Sure. Well, first of all, I had not planned to write this as a book. For
Okay.
me, at my age, clearly I have less years ahead of me than the years behind me. And I thought it was time to really do an accounting to delve into my life, both the positive experiences that shaped me and the negative traumatic experiences that shaped me, and how they would relate to each other. And a friend of mine said, "Peter, you should publish this as a book." And I said, "Well, why?" And she said, "Well, because it could really help a lot of people with their own healing." And I still was insecure about publishing it as a book. So when I'm in a place of indecision or have to make a new decision, often a dream will come. And in this dream, I'm standing in front of a large field, and I have in my hands a manuscript in both hands. And I don't know what to do. I look to the left, I look to the right, and I feel caught in indecision. And in that moment, all of a sudden, this breeze, this wind came from behind me and took all of these pages and blew them into the meadow, the land where they might land. And in a way, I knew the decision had been made, not by my conscious mind, but by my unconscious mind in the form of dreams. I also knew, no, I'm sure that most of the people who read it will find healing. I think probably some people will attack me to make themselves feel better. I'm not sure what the motivation is, but whenever you write a book, a certain number of people think, "Okay, well, let's get on this guy and then we'll be bigger than he is," something like that. But anyhow, it was difficult to formulate it as a book, but the decision, as I said, was made. And also, like you mentioned, to be known was for me in my history, in my childhood, something that was very, very dangerous and life-threatening, actually. And you mentioned mafia. Well, my father was completely innocent. He but in a strange way, that he was the district attorney made him testify against this mobster. His name is Johnny Dio. And when you see a picture of him in the book, you know that he's evil, pure evil. He's actually featured in two movies, The Goodfellas and The Irishman.
Yeah, I actually, when you mentioned that in the book, you know, actually what came up for me, and I wanted to share this with you, there was I feel it was like a sense of shame or guilt, because I really, really enjoyed mafia movies growing up. And it was the first time reading your book that I had the humbling experience of going, yeah, you know, that Hollywood and the glamour and the power and, you know, my masculine soul got sucked into that. It was the first humbling experience for me to go, wow, here is the lived experience. So I really just wanted to share that with you. It was healing in that sense for me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. So anyhow, in a way, I mean, very violent things did happen to us or happened to me. But was, I think, even more undermining was living with that threat for year, month after month, year after year, until my father finally went to prison for refusing to testify against Johnny Dio. Again, it was a horrible thing. It was on a minor technicality, but Johnny Dio said to them, if you testify against me, you'll find your family face down in the East River. So we knew that this was very serious, but it was never talked about. And that undermined our sense of security, because we knew something was wrong. We could sense from their body language, but never was really talked about. And if it was slightly talked about, it was talked in an offbeat way, in a cavalier kind of way, like we won't starve because we can still eat potatoes. And but we never got the message that we needed to get, which was, this is difficult, and we'll take care of you. Whatever happens, we'll take care of you. I mean, even as I say those words, I feel tears in my eyes, because I'm telling myself what wasn't told and what really needed to be told. But then there was an event that was extremely violent coming from that same situation. And, you know, in somatic experiencing, we never take the person right into the trauma, certainly not into the worst part of the trauma. And I know some of the therapies do that. They expose the person over and over and over again. And I don't think that it mostly is not helpful. I think it'd be harmful, really. And so I was starting to experience some different disturbing symptoms and some flashes of images. This is after I had been teaching this work, and it was already taught now to 70,000, 50,000 people. So I asked one of my students to sit with me, to be my guide, to see where these symptoms would go. So again, with her guidance, and she did it exactly the way it should be done, we went first to a memory of when I was 4 or 5 years old. And it was my birthday. And it, late in the night or early in the morning, my parents must have snuck into the bedroom and put underneath my bed some tracks from a model train set, back down to the other side of the room, and then back underneath the bed again in an oval. And when I awoke, I don't really even quite have the right words for it. I was just filled with excitement. I literally jumped out of bed, went over the transformer so I could change the speed of the train and make the whistle go, whoo, whoo. I was in heaven. And I didn't know the words to describe it. But as I look back, in that moment, I knew I was cared about. I knew that I was loved. And I could feel that in my whole body. And that's the key, to embody that feeling. Because when I next go to this very violent situation, I have that as a way to help balance it. Again, that's a typical thing that we do in somatic experiencing. So this stress about with the mafia, it's like it pulled my feet, my legs from under me. I lost my grounding in having that ongoing threat. But around that time, and again, I wasn't thinking about this at all, really specifically, but I could feel my guide was noticing a very slight movement of my feet. And she had me be aware of them and slow the movement down. Slow it down. Another key feature in somatic experiencing, slow the experience down. Just touch into it and slow it down. And then I remembered I had images of climbing over, coming home, having my milk and cookies, going downstairs, going across the road, over this tall wrought iron fence and into the park below. And I ran down the bushes to a running track below, another oval. And I would start to walk and then walk faster and then begin to run. And I could start to feel power in my legs. And in feeling that power, it was in a way the beginning of an antidote for having the power in my legs just pulled out from under me because of the situation. But one day something very horrible did happen. And it was the same routine, going home, having my snack, going across the road, climbing the wrought iron fence. But this time, off to the left, there were a bunch of, I'm sure, people from the mob. They were smoking cigarettes and they had these motorcycle hats on at the time. And somehow I knew something serious was wrong. And I thought if I tried to climb up the fence, I'm an easy target. So my body went to run down through the bushes to the running track where I would be seen. But something horrible happened. And I could feel somebody grabbing the back of my shirt and throwing me down to the ground. And in the session, we go through pieces of that violent rape, but only gradually, only touching into it each time, maybe touching into it a little bit deeper. And when I was done with the session, when we were done with the session, I felt that I was able to leave that in the past, to put it in the past where it belonged. And it was no longer haunting me after that session. But the other part about losing my ground and having all the worry for years, and then my father finally going to prison, that took me some more time to unwind that. And one of the other events, and I'm pretty sure it's in the autobiography, is when I first got the letter from my mother. I was living in Michigan in Ann Arbor. They lived in New York. And I was going to school at the university. And there was a very unsentimental letter. And it just said, "Your father surrendered himself to the sheriff today." And I just broke down in sobs and sobs and sobs. But when I did go back to visit my father with my mother in the jail, the words I wanted to say to him didn't come out. They got stuck in my throat. What I really wanted to say is, "Dad, I love you." But the words couldn't come. I just was frozen. But then when we were leaving the visiting area, one of the prison guards came up to me and touched me on my left shoulder and said, "Son, I want you to know that your father's not a criminal." And he also told me that my father was teaching the prisoners, the other prisoners, things that they could learn when they were released, because he was a teacher when, before this happened. And again, that helped me really shed some more of these tears. and somehow a sense of shame about not telling my father that I loved him. But having the prison guard talk to me made a big difference in that. And one of the things I think is essential for therapy, well, for all of us, but especially for therapists, in Greek mythology, there's an archetype called Chiron. And Chiron, the way I understand it, is the wounded healer. And as therapists, or just as people living in families and societies and relationships, I think it's absolutely essential that we do our own healing. We heal our own wounds. Well, actually, trauma, the word trauma comes from the, I believe it's the Latin, I believe it's the Latin word for injury or wound. And that's what it is. When I started developing somatic experiencing in the late 60s and 70s, there was the definition of trauma as PTSD was still another 12 years in the future. So thankfully, I didn't know that trauma was supposedly an incurable disorder, maybe even a brain disease that couldn't be cured, but at least could be imagined, that at least could be managed with certain medications and by helping people change their negative thought patterns, all of which are can be useful. But they're limited. They're very limited. And so when I developed somatic experiencing, I realized that trauma is something that happens in our bodies. That's one of the reasons why it was so important to reflect back on that memory of the train to my birthday, because I could really feel it in my body. In Papua New Guinea, there's a saying, if knowledge doesn't exist in the body, then it doesn't exist at all. That's another important component of somatic experiencing is the vital importance of embodiment. So anyhow, well, maybe that gives you a little bit of an overview from that part of my life, and maybe you have some other questions that you wish to ask me.
Yeah, it's an astounding overview. Thank you. A deep curiosity I have, Peter, is from your vantage point today, looking back from clearly a deeply trauma-informed perspective, and a little bit of context, for you coming on the show, to be the husband she brags about, there's family men. And a deep question for a lot of guys is when they become trauma-informed about their own past, it's how do we as men communicate, as parents, as fathers, communicate to our kids in a way through the trials and the challenges of their life, of our own lives, in a way that lessens trauma. So looking back, from your perspective, what could your parents have done hypothetically? How could they have communicated if you could whisper in your father's ear, Dad, this is what Peter needs, Peter, and this is what your sons need now. What advice would you be giving him, specific steps to communicate in a way through very stressful times that there were to support you not take on trauma?
Right. Yeah, exactly. This was again the thing to support us with those words that it's going to be okay. It can be difficult, but you, me, will be taken care of, all of us, me and my two brothers. That was important. And when I reflected back on the rape, it was clear, pretty clear, that they did that in a way, because if I went home crying and sobbing, and I told my parents what happened, then they would even be more terrified of the mafia. But I didn't tell it to them. And in a way, I didn't even tell it to myself. I walled it off back somewhere out of my consciousness. And again, it wasn't until my session with my guide that she was able to help guide me to heal that wound, to heal that wound, and to move forward in life. And I think around that time I did move it forward in life. Okay, you asked me a question about a husband. Yeah, I mean, often, and I'm assuming there we're talking primarily about heterosexual relationship. I mean, that's what I am, so that's what I know, of course. There are two components to that. The first is it's so important. For example, a person who has a wife or a relationship that's had sexual trauma or sexual abuse in her history, to know to really be supportive and to not move too fast, and to gently hold the wife or the relationship person, and just let them breathe and breathe together with them, but to have it that there will be no actual intercourse at that time until the wife is ready for it. So they can really do a lot. But, or, and it's equally important, at least equally important, that we do our own work. You know, and men tend to deal with trauma, well, you probably know very well, you know, where I'm talking with drink, you know, and it's kind of, you could say, self-medication. So it's really important to stop that self-medication enough to begin to see what it's covering up in our own lives. And you know, and then we can be present in ourselves and present with the other. And it's the gift that we can give both to ourselves and to our others. And it's the greatest gift to be able to do our own healing, to be present with ourselves, and then also to be present with our with others, with our chosen relationships.
The core part of your message through here, and I know through your books and teachings, is coming back to the wisdom of the body. You know, that is not wisdom if it's not in the body. And I know guys, myself included, up until 5 years ago, my marriage breakdown, breakthrough point and crisis was built upon, I had completely, it felt like a radical, complete disconnect from my body. Did not know emotions, did not like what the hell was happening below my chin. And I know so many guys listening in, that's the crux of their so-called issue. Guys will come in on application calls with me, and it's like, oh, I'm a rational guy, and I'm a rational-minded man. I don't do emotions. I'm not an emotional guide. It's like almost they're just front and center with that.
But you know what? When we can touch into our own emotions, we can be blessed with a deep, deep healing. And again, it's something not to try to do all at once, but just to notice when they might begin, even if it's like reading a book or watching a movie that has sad parts, to be able to touch with, to be touched by that. And to become, when we do that, we become more empathetic towards ourselves, and more empathetic to others, especially to our primary relationship. You know, when you, I was thinking over your title, I thought of maybe an alternative kind of title might be something like, "Am I the husband that my wife would want?" Something like that. And or if I were a woman, would I want to marry me? If so, why? And if not, why? So I think these are really important questions to reflect on. And I think that's, if somebody asked me for one specific piece of advice, that might be it.
You mentioned the example there of, a guy watching a movie, and there can be signs that come through the body of how you emotionally react to movie, to certain scenes, etc. What are other signs, for the male mind listening in, that this could be, for many guys, like it's mind blowing. What are certain key signs that a guy that is very new to this topic of becoming trauma informed, what are signs that he could pick up Peter,
Let me give you a couple.
that there's trauma present, that there's something that he needs to chew on.
Tension in the body and often chronic pain also, which is due to tension. Then also irritability, where we tend to explode at certain times with anger. And often anger is a cover for the softer feelings like sadness, like grief. And we all carry grief and shame in our bodies. And it's almost like, my reaction to all of what happened and to things that happened 50 years before that, 40 years before that, is I would tend to be reactive. So if somebody, say, for example, was blaming me for something, instead of defending myself, and this just happened with a relationship, instead of defending myself, I just say, okay, just let it be, let it move through me. And then I got a text the next day, really want to apologize for jumping at you. But if I had reacted back, that couldn't have happened. That healing part wouldn't have happened. So that kind of irritability and being able to ask ourselves, is this a familiar sensation, a familiar feeling? And can I kind of trace that thread back and see some of the places that it might have come from?
Knowing guys, speaking with the guys in Heroic Husbands men circles and one-on-one calls, every guy, I think, tension in the body. It's like every guy I meet, yeah, take that irritability, explosion, anger. There's such a common phenomenon. It's like I would say it's all pervasive. Peter, in your book, you detail profoundly the experiences that you had growing up and how that brought about an energetic and emotional block in you, opening your heart, opening your body into intimate relating with women and so on. Could you tell us the story about that? And the obvious elephant in the room is every guy listening in, they've reached out to this podcast because that is a core part of their lived experience. So I'd love to know more.
Two things. In my family, tears were not allowed. I remember distinctly a time when my father's sister died. And it's the first time I've seen him have tears in his eyes. I mean, occasionally he would have outbursts of anger, or occasionally happiness. But when the tears came, and I remember distinctly, I was out in the hallway with my mother and my father. And my mother said to him, his name is Morris, Morris, tears won't bring her back. And it's like I got punched right in my gut. Again, I didn't know what it was, but my body knew that it was not okay to have these feelings. So when some time later, a year or two later, my grandfather died, and I was loved and loved him. I remember sitting on his lap, and he had a pocket watch that was given to him as a ward from his work. And he would show it to me, and I would look at it, and I would put it to my ear to hear it go tick, tick. So I really, it was an important relationship in my life. So when my mother told me that my grandfather died, I ran back into the bathroom. I locked the door. So my mother couldn't stop me from crying. So I think that because when we shut down our our emotions like that, we shut down our capacity to be, to experience pleasure, to experience erotic pleasure. And in addition, when I was experimenting with one of the neighbors, as children do around 12, 13, 14 years old, again, my father caught us and he yelled, "If that's the kind of friend that Barry is, then he can't be your friend anymore." So again, just rip those things away. So the tears and the sexuality just got, I mean, I could have sex, but it wasn't really meaningful sex. It wasn't connecting sex. And I have to say, over the years, I've had some of the most wonderful women in my life that have really allowed me to be with them, heart and genitals together, and to connect to these deeper spiritual type emotions, which sexuality has that capacity to take us into spiritual areas, open-hearted areas. So I have to thank those women in my life who have been so kind and generous in their sharing.
I really don't want to get out the far side of this conversation with you without asking you to tell the story of your unique and maybe almost fantastic, literal fantastic relationship with Albert Einstein. It has truly cracked my mind open on energetic levels. So could you please share that?
Okay, that's the story. And it was one of the things I'm afraid I shouldn't put in the book because make it look like I'm kind of crazy. But
crazy is welcome here.
Yes, thank you. And I was working on my doctoral dissertation in medical biophysics, and also starting to teach the work which would become known as somatic experiencing. And I had long days at the university in the graduate school, and also trying to start to train some therapists. But toward the end of the day, in the evening, I would go to my favorite restaurant on San Pablo Avenue in Berkeley. It was called the Beggar's Banquet. And the waitresses there, they knew me by name, and they always invited me warmly to sit down. Usually they knew I would want to start with a really wonderful hot bowl of soup. And then with these French baguettes, which were like crispy on the outside and warm and soft on the inside. And I was, it's like some of the events from the day kind of faded, and I just felt nourished, really. But one time something really quite strange happened. I was sitting there in the usual small table for two. And somebody came from the left, and it was a man with wild, wild hair and a crumpled up suit jacket, a sports jacket that was like two or three sizes too big for him. And he motioned to the chair. And I realized he wanted to have permission to join me. And I said, "Yes, please sit down." And then it was absolutely clear that this was an image of Albert Einstein. You know, there's a phenomenon called active imagination. And I realized that I wasn't really talking to Albert Einstein, but some images and feelings were coming from my unconscious. And in a way, the active imagination, it's not about having hypnotic images or anything like that. It's something that really unites conscious and unconscious parts of ourselves, left and right parts of ourselves. And as a scientist, I would accept that this wasn't real, but it was imagined and seemed real because that's the way active imagination is. And I did a little research on it, and it said active imagination is something that children have But when they become adults, they lose that completely. And I thought, that is a shame, because that's when we need it the most. So anyhow, this went on for a year, and I would ask him questions, and he would ask me questions about my questions. This is kind of like the Socratic way of knowledge. And finally, at the end, I was starting to notice that traumas didn't just happen to a person in their life, but to their parents and their grandparents and their great-great-grandparents and all the ancestors. And so I was talking to Einstein about that. And in another image, he took me to a pond and held in his hand a yardstick, a meter stick, with stones on it. And he turned the stick, and the stones all fell at the same time into the pond. And then from there, it rippled out in all directions, forward, sideways, backwards, which would, of course, that was would have been something that Einstein was very much aware of, space-time, that it's not, that time is not linear. And then he showed me if some of these concentric waves got stuck, something interfered with them, then everything after that would be distorted through many and generations. So what I remember asking him, I said, "Professor, can you tell me then how to work with this?" And he said, "Peter, I'm sorry. I don't know that, but you do." And with that support, the next 2 or 3 years, I was able to really work with this. Okay, so that's active imagination. That's my unconscious talking to my conscious mind. Okay, now this is a little bit mind bending. About 30 years ago, 30, 35 years ago, I was visiting my parents in New York. And I'd spent the day downtown going to museums and so forth. And at the end of the day, came back on the D train, walked up the hill, and came in the door. And my parents, my mother and my father, were both sitting on a couch. And there was a bookshelf above them. And there were a number of books. And one of the books I noticed was The General Theory of Relativity by Albert Einstein. And so this prompted me to tell my parents, especially my mother, what had happened to me with these imagined meetings of Einstein. And my mother stood up straight and she said something like, "You didn't imagine that. That really happened." And I said, "What?" And she said, "When I was pregnant with you, I was 8 months in utero in my mother's womb. They were canoeing on this lake in New Jersey, and a wind came up and tipped the canoe. And they were unable to right the canoe and to climb back in, and they certainly would have died. They would have perished, and I wouldn't be talking to you. But just then, this small sailboat came along with an old man and a young woman, and they pulled my parents and me to safety. They then announced themselves, ready for this, as Albert Einstein and his stepdaughter." So my mother reasoned, and she could be quite intuitive, and I must really deeply appreciate that gift, I think, which I inherited from her in a way, that she reasoned that because of that rescue and life threat, that Einstein and I would be bonded forever. And I went, "Wow." So the both could be true. There could be active imagination, and there's something that is beyond.
Yeah,
And
I
at different times in my life, I've had some occasional conversations with Einstein. And especially in times when I'm in a place where I like my dreams, I don't know where to go or something's upsetting me. He would just listen. And I would talk to him, and by talking to him, it was a way of bringing it out so I could look at some of those issues.
From my personal life's experience, I feel it's valid both. Active imagination, it's like, yeah, I'll go with that. But there is also this part going, yeah, that feels like it's science going, yeah, we'll explain it there within the box of what we know, but
Right.
there's the box of what we don't know. And so I feel into that. It feels very validating for me in my human experience, the active imagination, because I know for years I would I've always had this dream, or like lifelong dream, of supporting people in the world, being a teacher, but that was a pipe dream for many years. Didn't shame in my body, family of lineage story, etc. But what I do, Peter, is on a daily basis, I'd go out to a room that was off her kitchen, and every now and then my beautiful queen would look in, and it's like, sort of like, who are you talking with? I was like, oh, nothing. I'm just,
Just
just whatever.
monitoring.
I'm not talking. What I was doing repeatedly was imagining. I was actively imagining that I was in front of a crowd, and the crowd were literally asking me questions. It was like, oh, what'll I do? I'm feeling suicidal. And an answer would flow, and then the next person, and the next person, or there would be one person, and I would have an entire conversation with them, and I would go, it would be like a coaching conversation. Eventually, my queen had to say, hey, look, I feel like I'm silly. I feel like really stupid here, but this is what I'm doing. She was like, okay, that's fine. That's perfect. I'm happy you know you're having these conversations.
Well, you know what I'm talking about. And I think many people, when they read the book and they read that part, they also can relate that they've had those kind of experiences and they've been formative. But we tend to, again, to push them aside because we're afraid of how we'll be judged. And that certainly was my case. And again, it took me a while with self-compassion and also getting feedback from others of how important it was for them to have those same kinds of skills, abilities, perceptions. And like I was saying before, it's a shame that adults supposedly don't have active imagination because we cut ourselves from a whole universe of knowledge by blocking that out because we're afraid of how we'll be judged.
There's the active imagination. There is also the other part of the energetic support. Because I know personally, when I look at mystical traditions, my comfort zone is here, psychology, just read mental strategies, etc. But then there is that energetic support, that skips how many decades, but there is that indelible energetic link between you and Albert Einstein, which it defies the psychological parameters of knowledge, definitely, that I have read up, and to make that link of just that energetic support that is available.
Yeah, I mean, things that happen that in a way can be ascribed to being mystical. But again, I think mystical is a different kind of knowledge, a different way of knowledge. Similarly with shamanism, sometimes people have said that, I'm a mystic and a shaman, and I would say no, because I was wanting to legitimize the somatic experiencing. So I just said no, this is just a scientifically based, like you said, neurobiological, naturalistic. But now in writing the book, I committed myself to follow my truth wherever it would go. And that's what the book essentially is about. There's a saying that Isabel Allende mentioned on a TED talk, and it's a Jewish quote, and it's something like, "What is truer than truth? Answer, the story." And Mark, I believe that we all have our own stories to tell. And even just telling them to ourselves can be tremendously beneficial, but we can choose to share it with others. But if you share it with others, you want to make sure it's somebody that, what's the word I'm looking for, that's trustworthy. And I realized that when I published the book, I would mostly be talking to people who are trustworthy, but to some people that weren't trustworthy. But again, I had to say, okay, that's part of the pain of this, but I still make the decision to tell the story, to tell my truth, to write about it, and to land the pages where they might fall.
It leads to my final inquiry with you, Peter. What you're saying there, that there's the truth in the story and finding an audience that is safe. And with your autobiography, there's an acceptance within you that there's an inherent unsafety out there that you just have to surrender to. Core to your work with somatic experiencing, to give context to guys, when they come to the work with me in the men's circles, very often they come with marriage difficulties. But when they stay in the work, Peter, very often it comes to their purpose in life. Their greatest mm-hmm. angst is they don't have a deep sense of meaning and purpose. So you on your journey clearly have followed your heart, your purpose. And yet when you entered into the biomedical model, mind-led, pharmaceutical intervention-led, passive interventions, etc., and said, hey, we've got to, the body has a major part to play in all of this. I imagine there was a lot of kickback. My key question here for guys listening in is, a lot of purpose-driven missions will involve that kickback. What supported you deal with the kickback in your body, in your nervous system, and allowed you stay the course like you have?
Two things. P and a C. Persistence and courage. It took a lot of courage to reveal some of these intimate details. And yet I kept going. I persisted in developing somatic experiencing. At the time, even talking about the body and how we have feelings in our body was verboten. You know, sometimes if I would give a lecture, some people, I think probably, well, I don't say what profession they are, but they would just storm out of the room and just slam the door shut. Like, this is dangerous.
Wow.
That this guy is teaching. And it was, in a way, it was but dangerous to our false egos, not to our deeper selves.
And in the face, because many people, it's, you know, public speaking is one of the worst fears. I think it comes in number one, number two. So you have these experiences. There's the persistence and the courage. Were there any particular low points where you questioned, where you thought quitting was more on top of the agenda than not?
Yeah, a number of times. But again, sometimes a dream would happen that was revelatory to me. I'm thinking of one particular answer. When I started developing this work in the 70s into the 80s, again, there was a lot of blowback. And I had the following dream. And in the dream, I'm in a room with this man in a black robe with purple sashes coming down over the robe. And I mean, I recognize him. I don't recognize him consciously, but it's clear that he's some kind of a spiritual teacher. And he hands me this wooden box. And without saying it in words, I know that I'm supposed to open another door to another room. And at the far end of that room, there's a cast iron safe. And I know that I'm supposed to put this box in that safe. And when I woke up, sometimes you have a dream and it's clear. I said, what is this dream? It's so unusual, but often the ones that are unusual are the ones that have the most importance or may have the most importance. And when I imaged the wooden box that he gave me, I remembered it looked like the treasure boxes in one of my favorite child stories called Treasure Island. It was about this treasure. So here I was given this treasure and I was putting it in a safe. What do you put in the safe? What's the word for safekeeping? And I realized that much of what I was developing had been around for thousands of years, but it was somehow my task to keep it safe by putting it in the scientific psychological framework, even though it comes from these deeper roots. And that's one of the things I really wanted to do in the book, is to talk about those deep roots and to acknowledge that I stand on the shoulders of not only great teachers, but of great spiritual disciplines. And I actually got to speak once to a Tibetan Lama, and I asked him about this. And he said, oh yes, this is not just in Tibetan spirituality, but in many different spirituality practices. And it has its roots in Stone Age Celtic religions, temples. And so I ran to the library and I found this picture from Newgrange. Do you know where Newgrange is?
I saw that in the book and it brought a smile. It's, well, I won't say just up the road, but it's in County Meath, Ireland. Beautiful sight.
Yeah. I have to come there sometime to see it. But again, it's that's been my task and that's been my truth. And I move forward with my truth no matter what comes my way. And if somebody really is attacking me, sometimes I just screw you, but other times I can feel compassion for them and what pain they're in and how they're being motivated by that pain. So
Peter, brother, it has been an immense privilege, an absolute gift at your presence, and you're literally in the body, embodied wisdom here. Thank you personally and on behalf of everybody here. For paying the price to be that safe haven, that safe for this beautiful wisdom.
I'm sure people want to read the book. You can get it wherever books are sold. Hopefully there are still some bookstores. And so I leave you my autobiography of trauma, my healing journey, and all of our healing journeys. Yeah.
Peter, thank you so much, brother. And for guys listening in, I will have all the links. They'll be in the podcast description.
Perfect.
So guys will be able to, within a couple of clicks, get some of the most beautiful books available. Definite must reads. Peter Levine, brother, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, yeah. My pleasure, Mark. It was enjoyable for me.